Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org.
Few reasons to like stocks.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Doug Krisner. This week's getting started with a sell-off in global stock markets. What happens if a recession here in the U.S. spreads to other countries? Well, Goldman Sachs thinks Japan's now in recession. And then the question of whether the worst is over for the big banks. Maybe we'll see more multi-billion dollar losses. Japan's Nikkei was down 4% overnight. Ditto for the market in Hong Kong. Meantime, the major markets in Europe are each down about 2%. It's a big week for Wall Street. The Fed's two-day meeting on interest rates begins tomorrow. Talk is we'll see a half-point cut. Last week, we told you about that rogue trader losing $7 billion at Société Générale in Paris. His name is Jérôme Kerviel, and this morning, French prosecutors say he could face charges of forgery, breach of trust, and fraud. Stephen Beard has more.
Jérôme Kerviel's lawyers insist he's not guilty of fraud, that he was just doing his job, although he admits hiding some of his activities. His lawyers claim that the bank had tried to use him as a scapegoat to distract attention from its huge losses on U.S. subprime mortgages, but that maneuver had backfired. Martin Arnold of the Financial Times.
His lawyers came out and said any loss that resulted from this was the fault of the bank for selling his position in a hasty way in a falling market. If the bank had held on to his position, they would have ultimately not lost any money, is his claim.
But Société Générale says the trader had bet $73 billion of the bank's money on unauthorized investments and had covered his tracks by using other people's computer access codes. Kerviel told prosecutors today that he wasn't seeking personal profit. He just wanted to be an exceptional trader. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The term in a New York second rarely applies to driving in Midtown. So last spring, Big Apple Mayor Michael Bloomberg introduced a plan to reduce traffic. Charge a weekday fee to drive in Manhattan below 86th Street. Well, this quickly divided New Yorkers. Since then, a state-approved commission has been reviewing alternatives. As Ashley Milne-Tite reports, a final recommendation comes this week.
Many commuters and business owners were furious at the idea of paying to enter Manhattan below 86th Street. Alison de Sereno directs NYU's Rudin Center for Transportation Policy and Management. She says the commission has been busy.
They've been looking at everything practically under the sun, from license plate rationing to off-peak deliveries to changes in parking pricing to tolling the East River bridges.
She says the most likely plan will still involve drivers paying up in certain areas, but she says there's a reason for that.
We have millions of dollars sitting on the table right now from the United States Department of Transportation. And if we don't come up with a plan that meets their criteria, we're going to lose the money.
$354 million, to be exact. To receive the cash, the government says New York has to charge drivers and spend the proceeds on public transportation. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with more than 70 national patient organizations to educate and support patients and their families. Online at Medtronic.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Most scientists agree it's too late to stop global warming. If that's true, seems like we need a plan B. Today we kick off our series on how we're adapting to a warmer world. While some look for ways to reverse global warming, investors are already funding projects to help us cope with it. Reporter Nate DeMeo traveled to Australia, where climate change may already be worsening drought. Now many cities down under have their eyes on water from the sea.
Ross Young is a bureaucrat. He runs a semi-private consortium of all the water utilities in Australia. And for 20 years, he'd tell a cabbie or a woman he met at a dinner party what he does for a living.
They would have yawned and said, oh, water, that's boring. Who cares about it?
But lately, his social life is picking up.
Now, you mention you're in water, and all they want to do is talk to you about it.
These days, water is a dinner table issue in Australia. It's always been a dry place, but now the country's experiencing its worst drought in a millennium, and its rain patterns may have changed permanently. A couple of hundred people cram onto concrete bleachers on the beach at Prince Philip Island, a popular day trip from Melbourne. They're looking out to sea, trying to spot penguins making their way to shore. Last summer, a timely rainstorm helped avert catastrophe here. The island's taps had nearly run dry. And with communities all over the continent having experienced similar crises, it seems the whole of Australia is looking to sea for a solution. Nearly every major coastal city here has a desalination plant in the works. Almost all of Perth's fresh water now comes from the ocean, and soon 20% of Melbourne's and Sydney's will too. But conventional desalination plants use an enormous amount of energy, and Australia is loath to follow suit.
It would be the height of irony if the response to climate change was to actually increase greenhouse gas emissions.
Wind, solar, wave, thermal, hot rocks.
Susan Truesdale is figuring out how to make Sydney's new plant sustainable.
Any sort of renewable energy proposals. We got 13 proposals in yesterday.
She says Sydney's massive plant won't increase the city's energy use or its emissions output a bit. It's the same story with Australia's other new plants, whether they're powered by on-site wind farms or offset by switching other utilities to green power. In Sydney, the average family will have to pay an additional $150 a year to cover that clean fuel. But throughout Australia, voters are willing to pay, and they're forcing politicians to choose sustainable options. The Australian public is obsessed with its climate footprint. It's been forced to be.
Australia is really the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world.
That's water bureaucrat Ross Young.
What we're experiencing in Australia will begin to be experienced in the United States. I think your time will come when you will realise that the rainfall patterns of the past are probably going to disappear.
He says the rest of the world should follow Australia's lead and find ways to adapt to climate change that don't actually cause it. In Sydney, Australia, I'm Nate DeMeo for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on Plan B, Hans Brinker and the Floating Houses. Our series was produced in conjunction with the Center for Investigative Reporting. In Los Angeles, I'm Doug Krisner. Thanks for listening.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.